A Zambian-born Namwali Sarpel's debut novel has been hailed as dazzling and has won several awards already. It's an epic, multi-generational story of the making of a nation. Zambia, since Livingstone stumbled upon Victoria Falls in 1855. The novel begins in the ensuing British colonial settlement of the Old Drift, the name of the book, where an accident sets off connections down the years and on into the future. Zambia was formerly Northern Rhodesia. Namwali Sarpel is appearing in Wellington at two events as part of the New Zealand Festival of the Arts, and she's with me now. Hello.
Hello.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Everybody says, oh, it took 20 years to write this book. I think you were doing a lot of other things as well.
I was.
What else were you doing?
I was finishing my undergraduate degree, finishing my graduate degree and my PhD, turning that dissertation into a book and going up for tenure at the University of California, Berkeley. So I've been working as an academic since 2008.
And also writing short stories and getting awards for them.
Yes.
Were they all connected with The Old Drift, those short stories?
Not every short story I've written ended up in the book, but the ones that won awards were.
Not every short story you've written ended up in the book, which is probably quite a good thing because we're looking at, nearly 600 pages
yes.
we're looking at.
It's a very long book.
Did the editors cut it back at all? Was it bigger at one point?
It was.
Oh.
And in fact, I apologized to my editor at some point for writing such a long book and said it would be better if we published it in three volumes like Jane Eyre, which is around the same size but appeared in three volumes. And she said, well, you know, you have cut it by about 120 pages, so I think it's okay that it be a long book. Okay. It tells a big story.
This is by no means important, but do you think big books are getting increasingly common now?
I think it varies. You know, if you think about the 1990s, you had books like Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which was over 1,000 pages. Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie is about 500 pages. The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, which was a big hit a few years ago, was quite long. So yeah. It sort of comes in waves, I'd
say. That's quite right. I'm just reading Hilary Mantel's third.
Yes.
In the Thomas Cromwell trilogy, and I can't even hold it up. I have to sit up and read it because you can't do it in bed. You get anyway. That's beside
your wrists hurt.
Let us talk about The Old Drift, which focuses on three women. You've got English Agnes, who is blind, and she's come to Zambia because she fell in love with a foreign student, and Sibylla, who's the daughter of an Italian housemaid. She's covered in very fast growing hair.
Yes,
and Martha Mwamba, who is constantly weeping. She is a Zambian teenager abandoned by the father of a child. A host of other characters, but these are the main...
Well, these are the main three characters in the part of the novel called The Grandmothers.
Mm-hmm. And so you've got daughters and mothers and grandmothers.
So grandmothers, mothers, and then the children. Because,
that's the
yes,
one.
Yes.
Some of the characters are real characters, and a couple of them are fascinating. One of them is Percy Clarke.
Yes.
Who plays a part in this accident at the very beginning of the novel that I mentioned. Who was Percy Clarke?
So Percy Clarke was a British photographer who grew up in Cambridge, England, but grew up working class and tried to get into a chemistry lab at Cambridge, was hired and then was fired under mysterious circumstances, decided to make his way to Africa to make his fortunes and came to the banks of the Zambezi River where there is what was called a drift, which is the deepest and stillest part of a river where you can drift things across. And he decided to settle there. And in his attempts always to try and get money, he was always scrounging for funds for his photography studio. He ended up at the Victoria Falls Hotel. There, he was trying to get money from the managers and construction workers who were building the one of the legs of the Cape to Cairo Railway. And in my story, he intersects with another historical figure, Pietro Gavuzzi, who was an Italian hotelier, the first hotelier of the Victoria Falls Hotel, and a Tonga busboy. And the three of them get caught, as you say, in a kind of accident. And this sets off, in my construction, a multi-generational cycle of retribution between their three families. So all three of those characters do exist, and they're all depicted in Percy Clark's memoir, which is called The Autobiography of an Old Drifter. And I used that memoir to start off the novel. I was really fascinated by this place on the banks of the river. All these people from all over the world, from Germany, from Poland, from Italy, as I said, from England, and all the Africans in the area congregated in this one spot, about 100 people at its peak. It's a sort of like a old West town. It was a settler place. And then they all died of malaria because they were too close to the river.
Malaria is interesting because your book opens with a quote from Virgil's Aeneid, which refers to mazy swarms,
yes,
and a hovering multitude. You, and these were spirits, you use that and set up your mosquitoes as a kind of a Greek chorus through the book.
Yes.
Because they are a real presence, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, as the novel proceeds, you know, they're speaking about human nature. And I say, what better than a nemesis to tell you the truth about yourself? And I set up Mozkind and Mankind as these kinds of centuries-old enemies that actually know quite a lot about each other and have coexisted for a very long time. So the mosquitoes form, as you say, a kind of chorus commenting on the action as these three families intersect over the centuries.
Have you been to the Old Drift?
I have.
What's it like now?
It's a graveyard. So it's a cemetery where you have these kind of falling down tombstones with names so rotted by rain you can barely read them. And it has, I think, 17 names of settlers who died at the Old Drift.
Of malaria mainly?
Yes, which was at the time called Black Fever. And you know, they called it Dead Rock. They were very aware that they were kind of constantly under threat of dying of disease out there. But they stayed as long as they possibly could. There was a real affection for being so close to the river. And I should say this is because the Old Drift is just a few kilometers from the Victoria Falls, which is this magnificent, majestic, incredible world wonder. And Percy, you know, ends his memoir saying that he can still hear them, even though he's moved a little further from the river. He can still hear them as he's writing.
You mentioned a Tonga busboy.
Yes.
Tonga is a tribe.
Yes, Tonga is one of the tribes in Zambia.
One of the many, you were going to say.
Yes.
How many?
So the seven main tribes. There are about 72 different dialects. And so one of the main interests of the book is the way that the borders got drawn around my country. And those borders were always shifting. They were always sort of strangely mapped by different hands. And they lassoed together a whole bunch of different cultures and tribes into one nation. By the time we achieved independence from the British in 1964, it became really important to try and pull these different tribes together into a single nationality. So our first president, Kenneth Kaunda's slogan for the country was One Zambia, One Nation.
And one party.
Well, yes, he was president for a little bit too long.
Your parents and you left Zambia. It must have been not long after Kaunda became president?
No, it was actually right before his successor, Chiluba, became president. So we left in 1989.
89. Was there a particular reason why you left? Was it political at all?
No, it wasn't political. It was for work. My mum worked for the United Nations Development Programme, and there was a position in New York. And my father, who works as a professor of psychology, found a position in Baltimore. And I think they thought they could commute between the two, but the distance proved a little bit too much. So we ended up in Baltimore.
How was that for you?
It was a big shock, as you can imagine. I had grown up in a very multicultural, very happy, very, bright and sunny childhood in Lusaka in the 80s. And, you know, I could walk to my friends' houses and climb trees all I wanted and loved going to school, loved reading books. And I came to Baltimore and I had no idea what I was supposed to sound like, what I was supposed to look like. People didn't know how to place me because my father is British white. My mother's Zambian black, and so I'm mixed race. In America, racial categories are quite strict. We have what's called the one drop rule. If you have one drop of black blood, you're black. And so I had a lot of trouble fitting into these different categories. I didn't sound right. I didn't look right. So it took me quite a while to kind of come into my identity now, which is as a black immigrant in America.
In Zambia, did you fit in?
Well, we went back in 1995, and I was a teenager then, and I had finally assimilated into American culture, and I found I didn't fit in very well back at home anymore. So it was this sort of kind of constant shifting negotiation of different identities as we move back and forth.
That's always tricky, isn't it?
It is.
But not bad for a writer.
Well, that's the thing. I always say I became a writer when I became an immigrant, because when we moved to Baltimore when I was about eight or nine, I have this little notebook from then, and it has all these little stories, and they're all about trying to figure out what it's like to be in a new place. So there's a story about a girl who tries to keep in touch with her friend across the oceans, and there's a story called Brainy Magic, where I'm trying to get into the heads of somebody else, and I can read minds. And then there's stories, murder mysteries, about which side of the road you're on, because in America you drive on the right, and in Zambia you drive on the left. So you can see this young person trying to work out what it's like to be in a new place. And I think going back and encountering Zambia as now a kind of American, I had a similar set of negotiations. How am I going to fit into this new culture? So I always think that moving back and forth into these new places it's sort of like a young person's exile. And we all know that many, many writers have been exiles.
Do you think that if this book had not I don't want to say taken so long to write, but started 20 years ago and finished now,
yeah,
it would have incorporated quite so many genres. I mean, people say, oh, it's almost impossible to... You've got historical fiction and you've got myth, you've got magical realism and social realism and science fiction, and it's a spy thriller.
Yeah.
Would it have been like that if you'd sat down and written it in the space of a year?
I think it would. Yeah. I know it's odd to say, but when I conceived the novel, I was about 19, 20 years old. And the first characters in the book were one family. There was Martha Mwamba, who cries all the time, you know, endless, endless tears for decades and decades. Her daughter, who becomes a sex worker, and her daughter's son, who is obsessed with airplanes. And when I presented this work in a creative writing workshop as an undergraduate, everyone said, well, is the daughter going to have wings? Or is the son, you know, he seems to be sort of science fiction-y. What's going on here? Why are there so many genres? And I just said, well, this is how they came to me. I almost think it was a pun on generation and genre, which come from the same root. So what happened over time is that more and more other writers started doing what I had instinctively been doing from the start. Someone like Margaret Atwood, Angela Carter, Salman Rushdie, even Toni Morrison, they had been writing in other genres, but putting them all together in one book, really it was people like David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, which is a huge influence on this book, Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, even Juno Diaz's A Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Those books, which were all published during that 20-year period, came in and I thought, oh, okay, that's my colleague, that's my brother, that's my sister. Oh, they're doing what I'm doing. So it almost felt like I was more justified in following my initial impulses. But that impulse was there from the start.
Did I read that you teach, you're a professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley.
Yes.
Teach black science fiction?
I do.
Is there a lot of black science fiction?
There is.
What distinguishes it?
Well, there's The category Afrofuturism, which was coined as a term in 1992 by a critic named Mark Derry, and he was referring, he thought, to an absence. He said, I don't understand why, when you have so many resonances, the idea of being an alien, the idea of being captured and mistreated, the idea of not quite fitting in, you would think there would be more science fiction that was black science fiction. Well, it turned out people had been writing it, but it hadn't been categorized in that way. So you may know the writer and great thinker W.E.B. Du Bois. He wrote science fiction. He wrote a short story in which there's a post-apocalyptic New York, and the only two people left are a black man and a white woman. So what's going to happen? How is the future of the human race going to work at a time when relationships between those people were banned, right, in the United States? You have stories from the 19th century where a black American archaeologist goes back to Africa and finds a hidden city with full of new technologies. So there are all these stories that were actually being written at that time. And then when you get to the 1920s, you have a story like Black No More, which is a novel by George Schuyler, in which there's a machine that turns black people white. And I don't know if you've ever read this, Dr. Seuss's The Sneetches, but It's a similar sort of thing, the star-belly Sneetches and the plain-belly Sneetches. After a while, it becomes really hard to distinguish. And of course, this is a satire of 1920s, the Harlem Renaissance. What's going to happen when everyone starts becoming white? Well, now everyone wants a tan. Now everyone wants to be black, right? Uh-huh. So it's a really hilarious kind of send-up, but it's based on a science fictional principle. And then you get, Samuel Delaney and Octavia Butler. And, there's a whole slew of writers who've been greatly influenced by their works as well.
You go into the realm of science fiction at the end of your book, of course, and you cast forward into 2000 and where are you, 40?
Well, 2025, but the actual last chapter is in 2050.
You'll have to keep on, we'll have to keep on writing addendums.
Exactly, as it comes, it's true.
One of the other real characters in the book talking about science fiction was Edward Nkoloso. Is that how you say that?
Nkoloso.
Nkoloso. And he was a science teacher who was involved in Zambia's space program, 1964.
Yes.
Tell me a little about that.
So he was actually the founder of the space program. And the way that this news...
Unofficial space program, we should say.
It's true. The government never really took it on. Even though he was very close to the former president, to Kenneth Kaunda, they grew up together and they were very close. And Nkoloso created the space program, announced it right at the time of our independence from the British. And so during our Independence Day celebrations, he said, we're going to set off a rocket. And when the Western journalists interviewed him, he said, well, we're rolling my space cadets downhill in empty oil barrels to simulate anti-gravity conditions. We're swinging them from trees. We have a catapult system that we're thinking of using to try to get to the moon, but we really think turbulent propulsion is the way forward. And one of his space cadets was a woman, which was actually pretty progressive because the Russians and the Americans didn't have any female astronauts. And her name was Martha Mwamba. And she was raising 12 cats to take with her to Mars to release them one by one to make sure it was habitable.
She really was.
She really was. And so everyone thought that he was a fool, a madman. He's been sort of taken up more recently as a kind of visionary. And
often hard to tell.
Yes, and because we have this new...
many visionaries are madmen. Elon Musk, what?
Right. Right, and Nkoloso said, I have a mind like a telescope. I can see further than other people. Mm-hmm. And you all called me, insane when I said we would get to the moon. But look, we got to the moon 5 years after I said so, right? So he was very aware that there's this line between the two. But what I've discovered in my research is that he actually had a real political education. He was very well educated for the time. He'd been educated by missionaries. He was training to be a priest when he was recruited to fight for the British in World War II in Burma. He worked for the Signal Corps. So he was on a plane when he first decided to go to outer space. And when he came back, he tried to set up a science school, and the colonial authorities said, you cannot have a native school. So they shut down his school, and he began to be politicized because of that. He joined a miners' strike. He led a civil disobedience campaign. He was arrested and tortured by the British and was sending telegrams to his friend Kenneth Kaunda in London, who was fighting there to try and get independence for the nation, for Northern Rhodesia. And he was a huge part of this freedom fighter movement to get independence. So there was always this kind of political history lying behind the creation of the space program. But that wasn't in any of the news stories that were coming out to the West. So I found all of this in research, in archives, in interviewing people who knew him. I haven't quite decided myself whether his program was satire. If you read some of the things that he wrote at the time, there's a lot of spoofing of British colonial powers. He says, well, we've seen natives on Mars, but we're going to send a priest there, but we're not going to force Christianity on them if they don't want it, for example. So there was this kind of sense that he was always somewhat more canny than the West was taking him for. And then his son said to me that he was using the space program as a kind of disguise to train guerrilla fighters for the freedom fighting movements in the nations around Zambia that had not yet achieved independence, like Angola, etc. So he was continuing this kind of political training of people well beyond the 60s.
One of your final characters, the final narrator, is Naila.
Yes.
Who's Sibilla's granddaughter.
Yes.
Right? And she is a political activist.
She is.
Are you satirizing her?
I am.
Right. Why are you satirizing her? What is your view of that kind of wholehearted young political activist?
Well, I think all of my characters, I try to have a kind of open heart and a gimlet eye. So
that's nice.
All of my characters, I'm satirizing to some extent. They're, Martha Mwamba goes from being this astronaut to having her heart broken and crying for decades. And I'm spoofing there the idea of heartbreak. I'm also spoofing the idea of Mother Africa crying for her children, right? So there's always a bit of love and a little bit of satire as well. With Naila, I really wanted to capture what seems to me to be the specific righteousness of the young woman, the Joan of Arcs. Right. The women, the Joans of Arc, I suppose, the women who are so stringent and so strident in their beliefs that they actually isolate the people around them, but whose beliefs are so radical that it's actually quite moving to see how committed they are to it. So I really wanted to give a sense of this woman who has a lot of insecurities and is also really struggling with her parents and their decision to create a business that she thinks is really unethical. And she's trying to rebel against them, but she is also just a young woman, and she's in love in this novel as well. So I wanted to give kind of both sides, and she and her two lovers try to create a political revolution, and there's a big rally that they hold. They use social media, this idea of a Twitter politics is something I also wanted to point to as a source of great energy and political possibility, but also a little naive. So halfway through the rally, it is Martha Mwamba and her group of women from the compound who come in, and they're the ones that take over because they've had political training since the 60s. They know what it is to actually forge a movement. So I wanted to also give the sense that you have to look back to the generations that came before who also were Marxist, who also were fierce, who also were women with a cause in order to really build a popular movement.
Let me ask you, later in the program, I'm talking to somebody from Zimbabwe.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got Northern Rhodesia, a.k.a. Zambia, and Southern Rhodesia, a.k.a. Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Does it feel like you are part of another country, or is Zambia a nation unto itself now The whole idea of nation building is, of course, a theme of the book.
So the novel actually includes a Zimbabwean character, Tandiwe, mm-hmm. who marries into a Zambian family. And the relationship between the two countries, I was joking with someone when I arrived here that New Zealand and Australia, I've come to understand, have a bit of a sibling rivalry. Mm-hmm. And we have a similar thing, Zambia and Zimbabwe. We're right next door to each other. It's a bit of the narcissism of small differences. But we are sister nations. We are brother nations. There was a point where we were all one nation with Malawi. We were all conglomerated together all of a sudden. Into what was called the Federation in the 50s. And it was actually that decision by the colonial powers to force three countries to merge into one that I think instigated our drive for independence altogether. So the political slogans in the 50s were not decolonized. They were down with federation, because the two nations had had the three nations had had such different colonial experiences on top of all of the different tribes that were being, again, lassoed together by external forces, that it just felt untenable. Southern Rhodesia had a very different racial relationship. The Dutch influence there coming up from South Africa was very different. They had a much stronger color bar. And this was suddenly being imposed on Zambia, which was a protectorate, not a colony. That, I think, is really what prompted us to become, and I do think we are, our own nation.
One of the, I'm going to be talking to the Zimbabwean playwright about a play he's written about Sir Garfield Todd, mm-hmm. who was, of course, Prime Minister mm-hmm. of Southern Rhodesia and also a New Zealander. Are you aware of that name? Is that a name that is familiar in Zambia?
Yeah, we're aware of it, but it's not one that we consider part of our history.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
I've been talking so much
to Namwale Sarpel, author of The Old Drift, and she is appearing at two events as part of the New Zealand Festival of the Arts this weekend in Wellington. Details on our website.